Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Eau Claire was in the national spotlight as the race for the White House heats up. Coming up, what the candidates had to say while stumping in a key swing district. Plus, there's been some prominent shifts on where voters stand on the issues and candidates in new statewide polling. And we preview what you need to know ahead of next week's primary election. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 9th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., this week we're going to talk about Eau Claire, which was in the national spotlight this week with a lot of media attention. And that's because there was three big players in the area, which is also a very swingy district as well, which we're going to get into in a little bit. Vice President Kamala Harris formally introduced her running mate, Tim Walz, on a big stage. There was a big crowd there talking to thousands of voters in the area. Now, this marked their first joint appearance in the battleground state, and it comes about 2 weeks after Harris was in Milwaukee just solo before she named her running mate. Meanwhile, about 7 minutes up the road, under about 5 miles, GOP vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance held a dueling event, in a sense, to do some counter-programming. He is following the Harris-Walz battleground tour to offer a completely different message than what they're trying to portray to voters. And he criticized the Harris-Walz ticket as extreme and liberal. But during all of their kind of stump speeches, one thing is specifically that Walz has been saying quite a bit about is he's been emphasizing his kind of viral moment, calling the Vance-Trump ticket weird. So he addressed that. He also talked a little bit about how he's looking forward to debating Vance down the road. Meanwhile, the other hand, and J.D. Vance addressed those comments of people calling him, quote, weird. So let's just take a listen to how both of them address that issue.
One of the best parts of this job is going to be I can't wait till the debate. So look, I've done this enough, and I know bullies, and I'm not a name caller, but what I am as a teacher, I observe things. So I want to tell you, what I observed and you've observed about these guys when you see them, that it's a very clear thing. Yes, they are creepy and weird as hell. You see it. You see it. This is not normal. This is not normal behavior. Nobody's asking for this crazy stuff. So I'll tell you what. You heard it from the vice president. You've heard her talk about this. We're sure the hell not going back. We're not going back.
I think that the weird argument honestly came from a bunch of 24-year-old social media interns who were bullied in school, and they decided they're going to project that onto the entire Trump campaign. And the reason it doesn't make sense is because you ask who's weird, right? I think it's pretty weird to be the border czar and to open up the border and allow fentanyl to come into your community. I think it's pretty weird to try to take children away from their parents if the parents don't want to consent to sex changes. That's something that Tim Walz did. I think it's pretty weird to want to defund the police. I think it's pretty weird to pretend that you're a tough on crime prosecutor, even though you pursued the policies that made San Francisco such a disaster when it comes to crime and public safety. So if they want to call me weird, look, I've got my wife here. I've got three beautiful kids at home. I'm a normal guy who wants to live the American dream and wants all of you and your kids to be able to live the American dream. That's why I'm in it. If those people want to call me weird, I think it's a badge of honor.
So J.D. Vance there was taking multiple questions from the press, which is something he criticized Vice President Harris for not doing yet. I know at some point she'll probably do rounds of interviews, et cetera. But first, just want to talk about being on the grounds in Eau Claire. I was there. I had a colleague at the J.D. Vance event as well. And the enthusiasm, I mean, was historic, I want to say, essentially, because yes, they are now reaching numbers. You know, this one in Eau Claire was 12,000, a little bit more than that, but then in Michigan, they were around 14,000. They just keep getting bigger and bigger, and now you're seeing these events being held outside. A lot of voters on the ground that I talked to, they felt like this is kind of the Obama 08 campaign, just the energy that people are getting excited about November, which wasn't there when President Joe Biden was still on the ticket. On the other hand, you know, I've also been to Trump rallies going back to 2016 that were also filling out arenas, so it's kind of just comparing all those different rallies, but this one is just something I haven't seen in almost 10 plus years on the ground.
So it's indicative of the feeling Democrats had where before, when Joe Biden was the nominee or going to be the nominee, that this feeling of dread of we're on this kind of inevitable death march. Mm-hmm. Like they felt like Biden couldn't win, but he hadn't accepted that and was still going to run anyway and drive on the ticket. Now that he's off the ticket, there says, okay, we've got a shot. The thing I caution people about from my conversations is even with all this energy and enthusiasm, they're basically back to even, right?
Right.
Kamala Harris is not leading most polls by 10 points.
No.
All this great run of stuff for her has got to like basically what we expect in the presidential race in Wisconsin. It is neck and neck. It's going to be a slugfest. The question is, can they sustain the momentum that they've got right now? And how are they going to define Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and J.D. Vance? We know Donald Trump. He's baked in. But Harris, how her number is going to perform, is Walz going to be an addition to the ticket or a subtraction? Republicans try to flood the zone right away this week with stuff about his rank when he retired in the National Guard, whether he tried to avoid going to overseas and run for Congress and abandon his unit, all this kind of stuff. All the tampon Tim is now trending, you know, among Republicans because of a bill in Minnesota to require feminine products be in boys' bathrooms. All on the list. Like, they're basically trying to flood the zone about him and say this guy is not who you think he is. J.D. Vance, we've already seen, has not been a net positive to date for the Trump ticket, right? His number's been kind of upside down. So it's all about trying to kind of configure this race and push forward to, okay, who are these players? How are they going to find themselves and how are we going to view them? To that point, Harris today has a new ad out in Wisconsin about the border. Been a soft spot for her, obviously, and Joe Biden in particular, trying to shore up that thing. So, you know, we're in a real race, neck and neck, and we've got less than 100 days to go.
Right, and talking about that enthusiasm, too, if you talk to any Republican right now, they're calling it a honeymoon phase. Mm-hmm. Because we've talked about this before, even before the latest MU poll that we're going to get to in a little bit came out, is that can they carry this for the next 3 months until November, this excitement we're seeing now on the ground? A lot of Republicans believe this is kind of a blimp in time, and then, you know, hopefully that will, what they believe, will open them a window to try to come on the attack. Because in a sense, right now, it's everyone's kind of talking about the Democratic ticket right now.
Remember, 3 weeks ago, we were talking about how Donald Trump survived assassination attempt. Republicans had a good convention. Joe Biden was tanking. Republicans were like, this race is over. That
right?
was 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
4 weeks ago.
Yes. They were so unified. They thought they had all the energy on their side, and then completely different shift in the presidential race, a complete reset. All right. Now, looking at the MU poll, I mean, within the margin of an error here, neck and neck when it comes to Harris and Trump here, basically a statistical tie. And that's because between registered voters and likely voters, it's just a difference of 1 percentage point. I don't think this is any surprise, but it does, of course, look good for Democrats because this is what they wanted to see, is her kind of close that gap that Biden had, which was never, you know, big to begin with.
In June, it was 50-50 Trump and Biden. That was before, though, the much maligned debate performance that Joe Biden turned in. The real key thing here more is about voter enthusiasm. That's what's shifted dramatically. But again, with this Kamala Harris, Donald Trump thing, it's 50-50. Worth noting that poll director Charles Franken asked if Biden was still in the race, what it looked like. And it was 47 Trump, 42 Biden. It shows you the trajectory that Biden was on, that now we're basically back to even, whereas Biden was gonna be going down. And then that opens the door to dragging down Tammy Baldwin, and congressional candidates and legislative candidates, they're back to even, which gives them enthusiasm and opportunities in places like the 3rd District in Western Wisconsin for Congress, the various legislative races. It brings them back to the enthusiasm you're talking about, back to the opportunity of winning seats they maybe could have won with Joe Biden at the top of the ticket.
Right, and that enthusiasm, too, is also like when I talk to voters in Eau Claire, would you have been here if Joe Biden was headlining this event? A lot of them said no. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing that people are just getting a little bit more excited now that he's left. Also, credit to Republicans, too. There's still a lot of their base is very enthusiastic looking at this MU poll. So it's not like they're lagging. But it was a concern just a few weeks ago on the Democratic side. Also, just want to touch on the issues because there was a slight shift. And what are the top three issues most important to voters? For the longest time, JR, we saw economy, immigration and border security at number two, and abortion policy number three. Now we've seen abortion policy move into that number two spot. Yes, it is only a 1% difference, but this is a good signal for Democrats who have been hitting this issue very, very hard. And over the past few months, what I've heard from a lot of Democrats, not a lot of them that wanted to say on camera, I'll tell you that, is that they were concerned that reproductive rights would have been overshadowed by border security and immigration policies because they knew that was a kind of their problem. And they knew Republicans are going to continuously attack them on that, even though migrant crossings are going down in the recent data, it's still an issue that they're going to have to combat with. And like you said, Harris is already coming out with a new ad because she's trying to get ahead of it.
There are still some fundamentals, though, that are in Trump's favor. Economy is still number one issue. In the Marquette poll, two-thirds of voters think the economy is not doing very well. Those are things that still are kind of a strong point for Trump. The question for Harris is, how do you not get bogged down by the Biden drag? Because she's part of the administration. She's his vice president. How does she not get tagged by that? How does she forge a new path on her own on these issues, convince people, I can address inflation when the guy I ran with and served with did not?
Right. And it also could just show that, you know, maybe the abortion messaging is working more. Maybe more people are in tuned with it. But there could also be a shift in this the next time the poll goes out as well. All the issues can change and the messaging can change as well. All right. Let's move on to another non-presidential topic, I guess I could say, which is a very contentious hearing on Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake this week, as they are once again under a lot of scrutiny after a youth counselor passed away there not too long ago. So state lawmakers at a committee hearing grilled officials at the Department of Corrections Tuesday over the safety at both of the youth facilities, like I said, following the death of that youth counselor at Lincoln Hills. Now, both of these, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake School for Girls, has been under a court order after widespread civil rights violations plagued the youth prisons many years ago, which led to a series of reforms such as barring the use of pepper spray and prohibiting solitary confinement. I'm bringing up those things because that was an issue of contention during some of the testimony that we heard about the battle of should we be bringing back pepper spray into these facilities. Of course, we know they took that away, but some people believe it would increase safety going forward. So let's just take a listen from someone's testimony on that issue.
As Mr. Sievert said, as staff assaults have increased since OC was eliminated, criminal charges for the youth have increased. Many youth leave Lincoln Hills, Copper Lake with many more charges than they came in with. So in an effort to protect the youth from pepper spray, the ACLU, the consent decree, and our administration have increased the likelihood that the youth will now have additional time incarcerated. I am not so foolish as to think that pepper spray is the be-all and end-all, or that having it at Lincoln Hills will 100% eliminate injuries to staff and youth. But if YCs have it available on their person, coupled with the things we're currently doing, it won't be the end of another life. If nothing changes, it is only a matter of time, and it will happen again. And we'll be asking the same question that we have been asking for years. It is not if, but when.
In addition to lawmakers grilling DOC, they also kind of got into it with one another just over the solutions going forward. When are we going to close Lincoln Hills? Of course, we know there's been a bill that's been passed for many years now to do just that, but they're waiting on some of these smaller regional facilities to basically get up and running before they even get that going.
So the Republican push was to kind of blame corrections for not fighting hard enough, essentially, for guards and their safety. The Democratic point from this whole thing was, you guys, Republicans, haven't funded the solutions. I think the Milwaukee Youth Prison will open in or break ground this fall. There's not been funding yet for one in Dane County. Corrections argue you need both of those facilities at least to empty out Lincoln Hills. There's an expansion at the Mendota facility here in Dane County that will help get girls out of Copper Lake. But the circular argument again, right? Got to close it. How do you close it? You got to open more facilities. We need money for that. Where's the money? Go round and round and round and round again.
All right, now we're going to look forward to Tuesday, which is the primary election here in Wisconsin. And we just want to first highlight some of the constitutional amendments that will be on your ballot. And the two proposals would basically amend the state constitution to restrict the governor's power to spend federal funds. So Republicans are urging their supporters to vote yes, while Democrats' message has been to vote no. And if approved, the changes would take away the governor's ability to unilaterally spend federal aid and require input from lawmakers. This all dates back from the COVID-19 pandemic, when Wisconsin got billions of dollars to help recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, and lawmakers wanted to say, hey, you got all this money, we want to have a say in how you're spending this. Well, the governor's argument, and they kind of had this tour to vote no across the state now, is that if there is another emergency like that, it could be, you know, a flood, it could be another, hopefully not another pandemic, they don't want to go through the legislative process, slow down that funding from getting out. They want to have the governor to, you know, have his own discretion to spend it freely. But Republicans say, you know, we want to basically have a say in how this is going forward. So interesting, you know, back in April, two other constitutional amendments backed by Republicans, authored by Republicans, passed. So Democrats are really trying to put more money, more ground game, and more messaging out there now in hopes that doesn't happen again this time around.
So looking at finance reports, the anti-amendment forces have raised $3.5 million. The pro forces had pulled together $15,000. I also got to note that there's two conservative groups, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and Institute for Reform and Government. They're doing digital and mail. They told me they're doing about $250,000, but still, it is greatly tilted toward the no vote. There are a couple reasons why. First, obviously, Democrats oppose the amendments because they don't want to take away powers from Governor Evers and embolden the legislature, controlled by Republicans. So remember what happened during COVID-19, where Republican lawmakers proposed things like using that federal funds to cut taxes. Other things that they were their priorities, which they said, we don't like and we don't know we can do. So there's that. But the subtext is, Republicans have been thwarted by Governor Evers' veto pen over and over again last 5 years. They are going to referendum more often to change, basically go around Evers and govern by amendment. We saw it this spring where they banned, through a voter approval, private money in election administration, and also restricting who can do election events. This is an effort to say, okay, can Democrats organize enough, raise enough money, get enough message on the air to stop one of these? If they can, will it dissuade Republicans from doing this going forward? There's another amendment on the November ballot about restricting voting to in school, local, state, federal elections to citizens. I don't think go after that one necessarily, but they may in the future, if we see more amendments from Republicans, you could see the playbook to defeat it. So there's extra effort here. Nothing to note, if you read these amendments, the language of them, one is fairly clear. One is not so clear. Talk about delegating authority.
The first question, yeah.
It's history shows if voters don't really understand an amendment, they don't really vote for it. I'm not suggesting it's going to go down because of that, but it doesn't help the message when you have lawmakers on social media or in their news conference. Yeah, it's kind of confusing, but you want to vote yes no matter what.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's a challenge. So interesting to watch how it plays out on Tuesday. And then again, what it means going forward for these amendments that Republicans keep proposing.
Right, and if it sounds right to you, yeah. Like even going back to some of the April ballot questions, if you read it, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But even, you know, you're talking about the one in November and only allowing U.S. citizens to vote. Well, that, of course, there's already, you know, policies in place to ensure that. But Republicans believe there's some loopholes out there, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, some of them you read it and you're like, oh yeah, okay. But and that's why usually they pass, but not all the time when you put a dollar amount on it, right? When you're talking about a school referendum, most people say, oh, that's my money.
The number one also might be a messaging thing to drive turnout for Republicans, just by the way.
Right. It is like it's going to be likely a very low turnout. We don't have a contentious U.S. Senate race. I mean, yes, there are opponents of Eric Hovde on the Republican side, but he is projected to likely come out.
That November one dovetails with the Trump message about immigration, right, and everything else. So
yeah.
It plays into Republicans' arguments about, you know, people around here documented voting and that kind of stuff.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's move on to stock picks this week and rising, talking about the U.S. Senate races. Well, we're going to see a lot more advertising, that for sure.
So Ed Impact did a look this week at the top spending Senate races in the country. We're number four, a distant number four. The challenge for Eric Hovde is it's 2-1 in Baldwin's favor. So looking at this, and, you know, July wasn't great. August is not as bad for Hovde, but it underscores a challenge he faces. Where we saw the Marquette poll, it was still a 6-point spread for Baldwin with registered voters, 5-point with likely voters, I believe. She doesn't have to worry about Joe Biden's drag right now. Now, I'm not going to tell you that Kamala Harris is going to stay at 49% or 50% all the way through to November, right? She may end up in the low 40s like Biden was. But there's this kind of relief in the Baldwin world of we don't have to worry about Joe Biden pulling us down. We might have learned only a couple points ahead of Kamala Harris and still win. Okay, for Hovde, the challenge is how do you get outside groups to invest in Wisconsin? The more polls you see that you're down by 5 points or 6 points, the harder it is to say I'm a viable challenger to Tammy Baldwin. Now, Marquette poll, I caution people that in August of 2022, it had Mandela Barnes up on Ron Johnson by 5-6 points.
Yeah, I want to say six, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go back to August of 2016, it had Ron Johnson down to Russ Feingold. Sometimes polls are off, okay, keep that in mind. But we've seen a pattern across pollsters of Eric Hovde is trailing Tammy Baldwin. Can he get people to invest in Wisconsin? Because yes, he is quite a wealthy individual. How much does he want to write? How many checks do he want to write to his campaign? up to $13 million at the last finance report. How much was he going to put in to keep, you know, even with her? And going forward, again, through November, it's 2-1 in Baldwin's favor. That's not great if you're trying to challenge her to break through. Doesn't mean it's going to stay that way. We saw a couple of filings this week. Fix Washington PAC did $1.2 million for Hovde and against Baldwin. Americans for Prosperity actioned $1.4 million pro-Hovde, anti-Baldwin. So stuff's coming in. But Fix Washington PAC is funded by basically people around here, like Eric Hovde's brothers donated to it, Liz Uline, some business people around the country. We're not seeing the big push from the National Republican Senatorial Committee just yet.
Just yet, right.
To help Hovde.
You know, something I'm going to be watching for, too, is see if Baldwin even gets more of a fundraising boost now that Biden is off the ticket. You know, we saw she wasn't appearing with him at a lot of visits that he was coming here to the battleground state. The last one, of course, she did, but that was with Harris in Milwaukee. But prior to that, it was the last one was in January. Her campaign always said, well, she's running her own campaign. She's got other stuff going on. But other people on the, you know, strategic side of things said, you know, maybe keep your distance because he's not polling well. But now that she's got kind of all the attention on the Democratic side of the ticket right now with the energy and the enthusiasm, could there be, you know, even more money that she gets in the weeks ahead is going to be something to see.
Baldwin played a long game with Biden. I mean, we talked about a little bit earlier. Come October, no one's going to talk about whether Jamie Baldwin had a rally with Joe Biden.
Correct. Yes.
In March, April, or May of 2024.
But it is going to hurt Republicans' messengers who try to tie her to Joe Biden's policies, like Eric Hovde.
So if she had called on Biden to drop out, she would have irritated Biden fans. If she had stuck with Biden, irritated liberals. So she just basically stayed back, let it play out, and now it's not an issue for her going forward. You still see Republicans say she covered up Joe Biden and his decline, but I don't know if that's going to be a winning message come mid-October in this race, or the dominant message.
All right, now let's get to Mix this week, which is Tony Weed, and kind of more broadly, we're going to talk about the 8th Congressional District.
So Tony Weed is closing this race, the same message you opened it with. He is Donald Trump's guy. The question for him is that enough to win this primary? Because Tony Weed, remember, is a newcomer, had run for office before, doesn't have deep ties politically to the district. He's from the district, but not like, he's not somebody who had a deep history of like being involved with the party or donating or, okay, you got to build infrastructure. You have to have people who go out there and like spread the message, knock doors, that kind of stuff. We don't really think he has that. Then you have Andre Jacques and Roger Roth, both on the ballot before in the 8th Congressional District. Now, Roger, he's got superior air cover. He's about, between him and the groups backing him, about $2.4 million, $2.3 million. Tony Weed, about 800 some grand. Then you have Andre Jacques, about $140,000, $150,000. So Roger has got this kind of thing going for him of more air cover, alternate lieutenant governor, been on the ballot across the 8th district before in 2022. Andre Jacques, well-known in the Senate district, but not well-known outside of it necessarily. For Roth, the question is, can you shrug off the charge in the Weed ad of that you're a rhino? Donald Trump looking at the camera saying Roger Roth is a rhino who should drop out of the race. And can you hold your own in Brown County? Roger is from Appleton. He's got that area kind of, you know, well-known. But Brown County is voter-rich. I think it's like 28%, 30% of the voters in that district. Can he hold his own when that's Andre Jacques' backyard from his state senate seat, where Tony Weed's from? Can he do well enough there, do well enough outside of that and his home base to do okay with Andre Jacques? The question is that kitschy we talked about last week. Does that ad breakthrough, he posts on social media about how many thousands of doors he's done and voter contacts he's had, can you ride this kind of like ad that sticks out and that kind of thing with Tony Weed and Roger Roth duking it out in the air? Can you somehow sneak through? Maybe. But it's going to be fascinating to see how important the Trump endorsement is in this race if that's really all you've got. And I don't mean diminish, but, you know, Weed's done some doors, made some calls, but he's not as entrenched as Roger and Andre are. So I'm kind of watching to see how that plays out.
And it's, you know, likely going to be a low turnout election too. So definitely something they're going to have to try to really get people out to the ballot box as well.
To that point in 2016, when Mike Gallagher won that seat in a three-way primary, there were 74,000 votes and change, okay? That's your benchmark. Now, like then, there's no statewide race this year or then to drive turnout. So it's what these guys do on their own to bring people out. That's kind of a challenge for them.
Especially in the middle of summer. Well, summer's dwindling. It feels like fall today. But all right, let's get to following this week and Joe Biden, which is specifically looking kind of too at his poll numbers because Dems, it seems like, had more of a messenger problem than their messaging.
Yeah, so look, again, we talked before. Some fundamentals still in Trump's favor, the economy, stuff like that. But look at the numbers. I mean, Trump v. Biden, 47-42. Trump v. Harris, basically even. 92% of voter Democrats are happy with their nominee for president right now. That wasn't the case. An uptick of 20% in enthusiasm among Democrats. There's only one thing that's changed since the last poll. That's who the nominee is. It shows you the challenges that Biden had. Now, also, it shows the opportunities that Harris has if Biden didn't. Milwaukee, for example. Milwaukee turnout in 2016 and 2020 was 57%. In 2012, it was 66%. Like Barack Obama, there's a natural reason why he's more exciting to black voters in Milwaukee than Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. Kamala Harris can maybe pick up that torch and get Milwaukee excited again. Yes, Donald Trump can run up the score in rural Wisconsin in ways we haven't seen before, but there are only so many voters out there. Milwaukee has been important in 20 and 2022 for Democrats, even with lower turnout, because it's still overwhelmingly Democratic. But if you juice that turnout even more in Milwaukee, you could have a nice thing for you for Kamala Harris. Joe Biden wasn't going to do that. Mm-hmm. So there's an example of the opportunity for her that wasn't there for Joe Biden. And, look, no offense to the president or his age, but he just wasn't generating the excitement that we saw with the Harris event. When he came to Wisconsin last time, how many hundreds of people were there?
A couple hundred, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And these events, they're carefully managed, they're planned out. They just don't have that same pull. Now the question is, again, for Harris, can she get far and away from Biden to not be dragged down by his troubles, right?
Yeah.
So his job approval upset him by 15 points. Like, there are all these negative things in the Marquette poll for Biden. Another opportunity for Harris is in that poll, like 3/4 of voters said that Biden's too old to be president, basically going forward for another term. For Trump, it's 59%. So when Biden was in the race, it covered up the Trump stuff, where Trump has had some verbal glitches, we're going to call them on the campaign trail, right? Well, if Biden not there, those get more attention from the national media. Trump did a news conference on Thursday. It was called meandering,
Yes. Wandering,
unfocused. There are verbal slip-ups there. That gets more attention, because now you have somebody who's in his late 70s running somebody who's 59 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different age gap than we saw before. And so, like I said, there's all these things about it shows that, again, not to pile on the president, but he was the problem as much as anything else.
Right, and now Harris is trying to not only pick up, like you said, the black vote, but off the young vote.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing quite a bit on social media right now with their messaging, and that is definitely something with the younger generation on the TikToks and Instagrams and stuff like that to try to reach them. All right, well, that would do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.